those of us who are a little older, the name of Paul Harvey brings back some incredibly fond memories from the past. He is a familiar, in our minds, a very familiar conservative voice that was on the radio for more than 50 years of time. And over the course of his career, he employed several memorable lines. There was his daily news program that I always loved when I was in the car at noon when he came on his news and comment, and he would utter those familiar words, "Hello, Americans, this is Paul Harvey. Stand by for news." And he would always close with two words, "Good day." In 1976, he began a radio series that eventually became six broadcasts a week. It ran all the way up till his death in 2009, and it consisted of stories that were that presented little-known or forgotten facts on a variety of subjects. And as Paul Harvey would relate these stories on the radio, he would hold back one key element of that story. Oftentimes, it was the name of some well-known person who was involved that you never had any inkling or hint that they would have been involved in something like that. And he would always hold it till the very end, and he would then sort of give you the line, and then he would add his famous tagline, "Now you know the rest of the story." In our reading through the Gospel of Luke this month, we have come across a very familiar account. It has been the text for countless sermons that have been preached over the centuries. It's a story that takes place in the temple as Jesus sits and he observes what's going on in front of him. And in that context, he draws the attention of his disciples to a single poor widow before he comments that she had actually contributed more than all of the others at the temple that day. Though her gift was insignificant by human terms, and certainly when compared with that of others, Jesus ensures his disciples that she had given more than the others because she had put in all that she had to live on. And about this time, you think you are about to hear a lesson, another lesson on sacrificial giving, because that's typically the application of this account, that it's here to remind us of the way that we are to worship God and the way that we are to give when we give to God. It is usually portrayed as a story of beauty in the midst of ugliness, that it provides us a glimpse of light amid darkness, that it's an illustration of selflessness in an environment of selfishness, that it is an example of generosity in an atmosphere of greed. And yet, while that is the common approach to the text, that there really is not a lot of agreement in terms of what the actual point is that's being made. There are some that say that Jesus is making the point that the true measurement of our giving is not how much that is given, but how much you have left over after you have given. Others that suggest that what Jesus is saying is that the measurement is the percentage of our means that gift represents. Still others focus on that Jesus' attention is focused on the attitude of total commitment that's reflected in the heart of this woman. Still others that the measurement of the gift is what it actually costs the giver. And there are some who even use this passage to validate that the giving of all and taking on a self-imposed vow of poverty. And while there may be aspects of those views that are valid, I'm not convinced that they are the primary thing that Jesus is saying here. And thus, I want us to see the rest of the story. Let's read chapter 21, beginning in verse 1. Luke records for us that he, that is Jesus, looked up and saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. He saw a poor widow putting in two small copper coins. And he said, "Truly I say to you, this poor widow put in more than all of them. For they all out of their surplus put into the offering, but she out of her poverty put in all that she had to live on." I want us to begin, first of all, by setting the stage. By the time we get to this point in Luke's account, We are in the final week of Jesus' life. Jesus has, to this point, made his triumphal entry into the city of Jerusalem. He has cleansed the temple. He has taught multitudes, the multitudes in the area of the temple, and also in this temple, he has been confronted numerous times by the religious leaders. And as those various groups of religious leaders, the Pharisees, the scribes, the Herodians, the Sadducees, as they have come to him, they have done so in an effort to try and trap him in something that he might say that would give them the reason then to have him executed. And yet what we are told in the Gospels is that Jesus has silenced them at every turn. He has thwarted every one of their attempts to snare him in the things that he would say. And so in response, we are told in chapter 20 of Luke in verse 40 that they stop asking questions. They understand that if they are going to succeed in their desire to get rid of Jesus, that they're going to have to approach things from a different direction. And we know from reading ahead that that direction is going to be the employment of fabrication and lies. After a long day of teaching, Jesus no longer addresses the crowds, nor does he address the leaders. After 3 years of ministry, he has now extended his final invitation, and from this point forward, he will focus his attention primarily on his disciples. Now, the next step that we need to take is to clarify the context of what we just read in chapter 21, verses 1 through 4. Let's back up a few verses and notice what Luke records for us in verse 45 of the previous chapter. He says, "And while all the people were listening, he," that is Jesus, "said to the disciples, 'Beware of the scribes who like to walk around in long robes and love respectful greetings in the marketplaces and chief seats in the synagogues and places of honor at banquets, who devour widows' houses and for appearance's sake offer long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation.'" So Luke tells us that he is directing this at the disciples and yet also within earshot of the people. And he issues a very sober warning in regard to the scribes. The scribes were the professional scholars of the day. They were, quote unquote, the experts when it came to interpreting the law of Moses. They were a group of men who had unrivaled authority in first century Palestine, and yet what Jesus reveals in these verses is that they are self-aggrandizing and they are corrupt. And Jesus employs four different phrases, each one highlighting their attempt to lay claim to an exalted social status. For example, rather than wearing the common garb of the Jew of the day, they would attire themselves with ostentatious robes that were intended to distinguish them as being men of wealth and eminence. As a scribe walked down the street and passed through the market, everyone was expected to rise and to greet them in ways that recognized their position and their great privilege. They preferred the chief seats in the synagogue. Those referred to benches that ran along the walls of the synagogue. They faced the congregation. They were where teachers of rank would sit, and it would be the best position from which to sit in order to address the group, because no one would ever be at your back. Jesus also adds that they love the places of honor at the banquets. Those are the places that are nearest the host. Everything about these men was calculated to provide to them the maximum exposure and to bring to them the greatest adulation from the multitudes. In Luke 16 and verse 14, Jesus describes the Pharisees as being lovers of money. Here, Luke adds that Jesus denounces the scribes for defrauding widows. That these men are guilty of victimizing rather than compassionately protecting and providing for the weakest and the most vulnerable members of Jewish society. Now, unlike the Sadducees, who were, as a general rule, quite wealthy, the scribes were not poor by any stretch of the imagination, but to varying degrees, they were dependent upon the gifts of the worshipers or generous benefactors for their livelihood. And so there were those who exploited their elevated social status to abuse the generosity that had been shown to them by others. There are a number of ways to steal money from the poor and the gullible and the zealous. For centuries, there have been con artists and crooks. There have been shysters and cheats who made their living by fleecing the unsuspecting, and their practices are not only ruthless, but they are also illegal. But there are others who discover, quote unquote, legal ways of doing the same exact thing, of exploiting money from the unsuspecting, and there are those who even do it under the guise of religion. And the scribes were those kinds of people. They used their position in Judaism as a means and as a justification for their evil. Josephus tells us in his writings of a Jewish impostor in Rome who, quote, played the part of an interpreter of the Mosaic law and its wisdom. So we have if he's not a scribe, he's playing the role of a scribe. And Josephus tells us that he had succeeded in persuading a woman of high standing named Fulvia to make substantial contributions to the temple. But the funds that she contributed never made it to Jerusalem because the interpreter of the Mosaic law embezzled them. And when the scandal broke, the emperor Tiberius in Rome at the time was so angered by it that he expelled the Jews en masse from the empire's capital. And it seems that that's the kind of thing that Jesus is talking about here when he speaks of them defrauding widows' houses. Chapter 20 closes with an uncompromising warning of judgment that even though these men who sought an abundance of accolades from the public, what Jesus says they would instead receive would be an abundance in the realm of divine condemnation. There are no more calls to the kingdom. There are no more invitations to salvation. There are now only pronouncements of judgment and condemnation against Israel and her leaders, for just as John states in the opening chapter of his gospel, chapter 1 and verse 11, he came to his own, and those who were his own did not receive him. Now let's look at the other side of our text, chapter 21, verse 5. And while some were talking about the temple, that it was adorned with beautiful stones and votive gifts, he said, as for these things which you are looking at, the days will come in which there will not be left one stone upon another which will not be torn down. They questioned him, saying, teacher, when will these things happen and what will be the sign when these things are about to take place? And so in chapter 20 in verses 45 through 47, we find a message of judgment. And in chapter 21 in verse 5 and following, we find an even longer message of judgment. And here he talks about the destruction of the city of Jerusalem and in particular the temple. And you'll notice what precipitates Jesus' message of judgment in regard to the temple. It is the comment about the impressive outward appearance of the temple itself, the beautiful stones and the votive gifts. And therefore, they must have been shocked when Jesus says that there will not be one stone left upon another, that this magnificent structure and the corrupt religious system that existed within its walls would eventually be destroyed in divine judgment in 70 AD. By the time of Jesus, by this point in time in Luke chapter 21, Herod's remodeling project of the temple had already been going on for about 46 years, according to John 2 and verse 20. And it won't even be completed for another 30 years beyond this point in time, in the mid-60s, just prior to God destroying it or using the Roman army to destroy it. Now, we've set the stage. We've clarified the context. Let's identify the intention. What's Jesus actually saying in chapter 21 and verses 1 through 4? Again, it's important to remember that the Bible is not a collection of independently assembled inspirational stories. And therefore, context matters. And that's certainly the case here. I also remind you that there is no chapter break in the original. And so forget that big 21 for a moment. And so as Luke continues his narrative, he places Jesus in the same place that he's issued the warnings about the scribes at the end of chapter 20. And here Luke tells us that that position is within eyesight of the treasury. The treasury was located in what was known as the court of women. It was a large open area where obviously both men and women could go to worship. There was a courtyard inside of the court of women. That was the court of men. And obviously men could go there, women could not. But this was a large open area where those of both genders could come to worship God. And it was also the place where you could go to make your financial contributions. The Jews had set up 13 large trumpet-shaped metal containers. And each one of them was labeled, and it indicated what the money that was deposited into that particular container would be used for. It was an open area. It was a public area. It was easily accessible for everyone to be able to make their contributions. But that openness also helped to contribute to some looking to put their giving on display. And Jesus, you remember, condemns that in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapter 6, beginning in verse 2. The word treasury that Luke uses here is a combination of two Greek words. One word spoke of a thing stored, and the other word spoke of something that was guarded. And so these trumpet shapes, so you had a narrow opening at the top and then it flared out as you went down. It was in the shape of a shofar, the ram's horn. It was in that shape. And the shape of it allowed that when money was put in, it was guarded. It was held because you couldn't get your hand in the top, and thus it helped to prevent theft. Now, Mark, in his account of this, in chapter 12 and verse 41, tells us that Jesus began observing. And the word that he uses there describes an observation not that is accidental, but that is deliberate. It is from this place where Jesus is seated in the court of women that he purposely begins to watch as people put their gifts into the temple treasury. Another thing that's important for us to understand is that when Jesus, or when Luke uses the word rich there in verse 1, when Jesus saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury, that we're not talking about Howard Hughes or Bill Gates rich, okay? This is a general word that described those who could put something into the treasury, even a substantial amount, and still have enough to live on, which is pretty much all of us. But as Jesus observes, he not only sees the rich putting their money in, he sees this poor widow. This, by the way, there's 7 references to a widow in Luke's gospel. This is the last of the 7. And that particular word, widow, should take our minds back to chapter 20 and verse 47. This reference to them devouring widows' houses. Now, Jesus, if this was simply about giving, Jesus could have used a poor man putting money in. He could have used a poor woman putting money in. Instead, specifically, he points out a poor widow. The word poor, not found anywhere else in the New Testament, and it was a word that spoke more of an impoverished person rather than describing that person's circumstance of poverty. In other words, this is a needy person. This is a person who is in want. She's not totally destitute. It's way down there, but it's not at the very bottom. But in the process of her giving, she goes from way down there to being at the very bottom. She will leave the temple totally destitute. As Jesus watches, Luke tells us that she puts in 2 copper coins, is how the New American Standard translates it. Lepta is the word here. It is the smallest coin that was in circulation at the time. And depending who you read, it was anywhere from 1/64th of a denarius to 1/100th of a denarius. If it's a 1/100th, it's about 8 minutes of labor at minimum wage. It was not lawful to offer less than 2 of these. And so what we find here is the smallest contribution that was made by any person ever. No one could have given less than what this woman gives. Now, while in financial terms her offering is negligible, Jesus says that she has put in more than all. And Luke tells us that he makes his evaluation based on the fact that they gave out of their surplus. She gives out of her poverty. She gives all that she has to live on. Everybody else that gave to the Lord, but still had something that they could go home and live on. Now, the typical view of these verses is that they are intended to provide us with this stark contrast between the self-seeking, status-loving scribes, the experts in the law who devour widows' houses, and to contrast them with the remarkable and sacrificial generosity of this poor widow. But again, among those who take that view, there is not agreement in terms of the exact point that's being made. Is the measurement how much you give? Is the measurement how much is left over? Is Jesus saying that it's a matter of proportion? Or is it a matter of one's attitude? What I want you to notice is what the text doesn't say. Jesus doesn't say that the rich proportionally gave too little. Jesus doesn't say that after they gave, they had too much left over. Jesus does not condemn them, nor does he supply a negative comment about the rich and what they have given. He doesn't say that this widow gave the ideal amount. He doesn't say that she gave it with the right spirit. She could have just as easily given it out of fear or guilt or being manipulated as she could have giving it out of devotion. We simply don't know because Jesus doesn't say, and Luke does not provide us with any kind of editorial comment. The only thing Jesus says is that she gave more than everybody else because they gave out of a surplus. She gave out of her poverty, and she gave all she had. Again, Jesus doesn't say, I want you to give with the same attitude as this woman has just given. He doesn't say, if you're totally dedicated to God, you're going to give the same percentage as this woman gave. He doesn't even say, now there's a woman who truly trusts God. And it seems to me that if this text is teaching any principle in the realm of giving, it would have to be that God expects us to give 100% to the extent that we have absolutely nothing left to live on. That's what it means to really be devoted. That's what it means to truly be spiritual, that you give everything you have. That's not what we see played out in the book of Acts. And clearly that in the rest of Scripture is not what God says at all. The reality, that's not how any of us give. It's not how the faithful in the book of Acts gave. Most of us this morning put in a financial contribution to the Lord, and we did so out of our surplus. So is that wrong? Is that not the kind of giving that is Jesus condemning giving that you have something left over? No, that's not what's taught in the New Testament. In fact, we have put some into the treasury, and many of you will go out to lunch today. You have enough money left over. You can actually go buy your own meal. And over the years, people have used or misused this passage and ones like it to promote guilt and to manipulate and to compel individuals and congregations to give beyond their means. These four verses have been used to preach the message that you haven't given anything to God unless you have given until it hurts, until you've given sacrificially. Now, there are other passages that tell us that we need to be giving sacrificially. This just, I don't think, is one of those. And because of that tactic that has been used of applying this verse, churches in our day have become known as money grubbers. We all acknowledge that. Where did that come from? Worldly people didn't just make that up. It's a reputation that was earned over years of time. And misapplications of this have simply given unbelievers another excuse to ignore God, that all those churches are interested in is my money. And that, sadly, has been earned by many churches legitimately. Now, the Lord's intention may have been to point to this widow as an example of someone who is materially poor, but who is spiritually rich. He may be pointing to this woman as an example of someone who is not anxious about her life, but is dependent upon God, that she puts God's kingdom first. That may be what he's saying. I just don't think the context suggests that. I think the context suggests something totally different. Hold your place here. Look back at the Gospel of Mark. Look at Mark chapter 7. Because here we see a different example of what was going on in the devouring of widows' houses, if you will. So look at Mark chapter 7, beginning in verse 9. Prior to this, by the way, the Pharisees, in these earlier verses of the chapter, the Pharisees and the scribes have confronted Jesus because his disciples don't go through the certain ceremonial washing before they eat their meal. And Jesus responds by charging them with transgressing the commandment of God for the sake of their tradition. Picking up now in verse 9. He was also saying to them, "You are experts at setting aside the commandment of God in order to keep your tradition. For Moses said, 'You honor your father and your mother, and he who speaks evil of father or mother is to be put to death.' But you say, 'If a man says to his mother or father or his mother, whatever I have that would help you is Corban, that is given to God, you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or his mother, thus invalidating the word of God by your tradition, which you have handed down, and you do many things such as that." In verse 9, he labels them experts in setting aside the commands of God. He reminds them of what Moses actually said in terms of honoring father and mother. And then he turns around and he says, "But you say something different." That where God commanded the honoring of father and mother, which included ensuring that their parents' needs were met, these men advocated ways of claiming that the money that might have helped their parents was something that was already donated to God. That they were guilty of inventing a religion that had nothing to do with the commands of God. In fact, they had even come up with a word for it. It is Corban. It is dedicated, devoted to God. I'm sorry, I can't help you, Mom and Dad, because I'm too busy serving the Lord. I'm too busy contributing to the temple. I'm too busy supporting Judaism, is the idea. God's law was never given to impoverish people. Man was not made for the law. The law was made for man. And yet here in Luke chapter 21, we find a religious system that was willing to take a poor widow's last 2 cents under the pretense that that would please God. How does it make you feel when you learn that St. Peter's was at least in part built upon the backs of the poor in regard to the sale of indulgences? That was one of the main issues that Martin Luther had that compelled him to try and reform the Catholic Church. How does it make you feel when you learn that one of the largest group of givers to today's charismatic prosperity preachers are single women who are promised money and health and sometimes even husbands if they'll simply send in their money to this guy? And friends, those kinds of stories are all too common. How would it make you feel if you watched here this morning is a widow emptied her bank? Scratch that. That's not the example I want to use. How would it make you feel if a poor widow that you knew emptied her bank account and under the compulsion of religious devotion sent those funds to a corrupt preacher? Now, if I'm the corrupt preacher, then I guess the analogy plays out. But hopefully I'm not that. But she says, she empties her bank account and she sends her last dime to some corrupt preacher that's going to take that money and he's going to use it to support his own self-indulgent lifestyle. How would that make you feel? I think that's the feeling Jesus has here. Context matters. And therefore, the primary point that's being made here is not a widow who stands the marvelous example of generous giving. She may be that. What we have here is a woman who provides Jesus and us with the final proof that the time has come for the old to go away and for the new to come. Throughout the law, we read of numerous provisions that are made for a woman in this position, widows. We read through the prophets of God's anger when his people later in Israel's history deprived and robbed widows of what they needed to live on. Isaiah 1 verse 23, for example, "You rulers are rebels and companions of thieves. Everyone loves a bribe and chases after rewards. They do not defend the orphan, nor does the widow's plea come before them. Isaiah 10 verses 1 and 2. Woe to those who enact evil statutes and to those who constantly record unjust decisions to provide, to deprive the needy of justice and rob the poor of my people of their rights so that widows may be their spoil. Ezekiel 22 verse 6 and 7. Behold, the rulers of Israel, each according to his power, have been in you, that is in the temple, for the purpose of shedding blood. They have treated father and mother lightly within you. The alien they have oppressed in your midst. The fatherless and the widow they have wronged in you. And yet in spite of the teaching of the law and the warning of the prophets, in spite of the horror of the captivity that came, at least in part of their defrauding and robbing those who were vulnerable in their own culture, widows and orphans, what Jesus finds in his own day is that those who are in charge of Judaism are busy doing exactly the same thing. They are commandeering the resources of the poor to enrich themselves. That they love the honor, and they crave the notoriety, and they are willing to devour a widow's house in order to get and to maintain that status and that lifestyle. What I believe we find in these verses is a marvelous example of that. That in spite of the law's clear provision for widows, this woman's house has been devoured to the extent that the only thing she has left are a couple of copper coins, and they take those from her as well. The law said those funds should have provided for this woman. And not only that, but those rich who were putting in out of their surplus, where were they to help this woman? To have something to live on. Back in chapter 19, in verses 45 and 46, Jesus, as he speaks about the temple, refers to it that it was intended to be a house of prayer. They have turned it into a den of robbers. A den, that's where lions hide out. The temple has become a hideout for thieves, Jesus says. And this dear woman, perhaps manifesting true devotion, who continued to faithfully support the temple and its corrupt religious system that existed within it, in spite of having been exploited to the point that it now drives the final nail in her coffin. And now you know the rest of the story. And may we look at this passage different than we've looked at it before. She maybe have been an incredibly generous woman. She certainly was willing to do something that I would not have done, but I'm not a widow. I'm not in that kind of a situation. But you and I talk to people. We know of those in our past who, out of religious fervor, gave to corrupt people money that they didn't have to give away. And that's what Jesus is condemning here. This morning, respond to the invitation of Jesus. Don't harden your heart to the point that these religious leaders did, that even the Son of God comes to the point when the invitations are no longer extended, and all that's left are words of judgment. You have opportunity now. You have opportunity today, this moment, to give your heart to God. To serve Him with all your heart and with all your mind, to devote yourself totally to Him. And we hope that you'll take that step right now. Won't you come while together we stand and sing.